Good morning, or afternoon, depending on where you live. I believe we have an excellent program for you today. This webinar is being brought to you by the American Agricultural Economics Association, Extension Section, and the Western Extension Committee's Ag in Uncertain Times team. I'm Jeff Trunell, Agricultural and Business Management Economist with Colorado State University. I also want to thank the skilled and knowledgeable team behind the scenes making sure things run smoothly. They include Shannon Nyberg at Washington State University and Director of the Western Center for Risk Management Education, John Hewlett, the University of Wyoming, John Nelson at the Western Center for Risk Management Education, Bob Craven at the University of Minnesota Center for Farm Financial Management, Trent Tigerstum at the University of Arizona, and Romero Lobo at the University of California. Montana State University Extension is our technology host. Drought conditions and other natural disasters have caused widespread effects across the farm economy by increasing price volatility and production risk, as well as increasing financial uncertainty. Farmers and ranchers may be forced to sell livestock, find less expensive inputs, use fewer inputs, resulting in lower yields, change enterprises, or even sell their entire operations. Some producers may even be forced to make life-changing decisions. I believe we have three highly knowledgeable speakers today addressing the issues pertaining to tax and financial risk due to drought disaster. The first two speakers will give live presentations, and each has agreed to answer a few questions following his address. Their presentations will be recorded and made available on the farmmanagement.org website beginning later this afternoon. The third speaker had a conflict in his schedule, so his presentation was recorded in advance. Before we get started today, there are a few housekeeping items. First, we ask that you use the Q&A pod found on the lower left side of your screen to ask questions or make comments. Simply put your cursor in the input box, type your question or comment, and click on the icon found just to the right of the input box. The team behind the scenes will make the questions available to me to ask the speaker. If you are having some technological issues, the team will attempt to help you. Secondly, you should be able to see an icon at the upper right side of your screen, which reads full screen. By clicking on it, you will enlarge the slides for better viewing. Since a full screen mode covers the Q&A pod, you will need to toggle between the two to reveal the pod and ask your question. Finally, you will see polling questions occasionally appear on your screen. Please respond to the questions as they appear. The information will be helpful to the team. Our first speaker this morning is J.C. Hobbs. J.C. is an assistant education specialist at Oklahoma State University. His areas of emphasis are farm income tax management, estate planning, farm business management, and farm transition planning. He also coordinates the OSU Farm and Business Tax Schools. He writes a number of tax-related fact sheets, which are available at the website ruraltax.org. I've gotten to become better acquainted with JC's knowledge and skills in the farm tax areas as we serve together on the National Farm Income Tax Task Force. This group provides information to the Internal Revenue Service and develops a plethora of fact sheets and tax-related information for producers. JC brings to the group a unique combination of knowledge about income taxes and production agriculture. JC, we are looking forward to your comments, so I will let you take over from here.
Thanks, Jeff. As he stated, I'm with Oklahoma State University. I have been given the honor of talking about weather-related sales of livestock. What we're going to be talking about today are the rules that apply to two types of situations. One is when we deal with livestock, again, all types of livestock sold to weather-related conditions, that being flood, drought, any condition causing a shortage of either water or feed or both. What it does is the rules allow a taxpayer to avoid bunching of income by allowing the taxpayer to postpone recognition of income, that being gain or sales proceeds, from 1 year to a future year, or even postpone it further by allowing them to replace with like livestock. We'll talk about both of these in detail. The rules state that we have to have, or we need information concerning drought level, declarations, things of this nature. And these have impact on both the two tax treatments. If you look at the sources for drought and disaster information, the declarations, FEMA, Farm Service Agency gets our Secretary of Ag declarations, and then also the U.S. Drought Monitor Maps also gives the drought intensity. And all of these have impact upon the various tax treatments and the rules that apply. So there's two different tax treatments. Both of them apply to rural sales in excess of normal for livestock. Normal being what is normally, the farmer normally sells in a typical year. Due to the drought condition, anything in excess of that would be what is allowed to either be deferred or postponed. The first code section that I've listed there basically applies to any livestock. So calves, feeder pigs, anything that we sell, including draft dairy breeding animals. The second rule, 1033, the involuntary conversion rules, it applies only to draft breeding dairy, no poultry included in that opportunity. So there's the two code sections in case you need to take this information to your tax preparer. I've listed those just in case you might need them. Then we have two types of taxable income that occur. You've got ordinary income. That shows up on the Schedule F, that sale of calves, sale of feeder pigs, things like this. Also, if for purchased breeding livestock where you have a basis for depreciation, any recapture of depreciation is ordinary income as well. Now, the other type of income is capital gain income. Sale of proceeds from raised breeding livestock. Now, with raised breeding livestock, you've deducted the cost of raising those animals. The basis is zero. So anything that you sell those for is capital gain income. It all applies there. So the basis is zero. When you sell raised breeding livestock, it's all capital gain income. Capital gain can apply to purchased breeding livestock when the sale price exceeds what you paid for them. So if you paid $1,000 for this cow, you've depreciated her down, and you sell her for $1,200, $200 is capital gain income. So you've got two situations, two scenarios, ordinary income and capital gain income that you've got to work with. Now let's go through the first set of rules as they apply to the 451E, that's a one-year postponement to all breeding or all livestock. And all it states is drought, flood, weather condition has to be severe enough that we get a federal disaster declaration. I'll tell you in a moment where you can find information out on that. Basically, FEMA is the primary source. Also, the Secretary of Ag can also have disaster declarations for a particular area. All you have to do is show that the weather-related condition, the drought, cause you to sell more animals than you would have normally sold in a typical year. So if you normally sell 25 head out of your 100 cows annually for culling, this year you sold 50 due to the drought. That excess 25 is what we would be treating for the one-year deferral. Or same thing with calves. If you run out of pasture in the fall or summer and normally would have held those through to the following year, then those sales would be allowed to be deferred. Now, the rules say a cash basis farmer, he has to use the cash method of accounting, and that applies to most farmers. Remember what I said earlier, applies to any livestock, draft, breeding, dairy, also calves, feeder pigs, doesn't matter. That rule allows for the one-year postponement, so you defer the income from the year they were sold until they would normally be sold. So the sale proceeds deferred to the next taxable year. But there are certain requirements that have to be met. Principal business must be farming. So essentially 50% of the gross income must come from the farm business. And this sounds like a major problem or a major hurdle. it really is not that big of a hurdle to jump over that. So the principal business being farming, not much of a problem. Cash method of accounting, we have very few folks, farmers, that are required to use the accrual method. So most farmers using cash method, so they automatically qualify there. The question of animals would have been normally sold in the following year, basically you're going to have to look at your sales proceeds. That information is available on the Schedule F, and it's pretty easy to find that information by going back to your historical records and seeing what is a normal sale. That's fairly easy to get a handle on. The fourth item, weather-related condition, well, causes us to be eligible for federal assistance. There you've got to go to either FEMA or you've got to go to the Secretary of Ag disaster declarations and determine whether or not those apply. The drought monitor maps will not work in this scenario. Now here comes neat information. The livestock, well, those sold in excess of normal, they do not have to be raised or sold in the declared disaster area. All it has to have is that weather-related condition. The drought caused it to be declared eligible for federal assistance. To give you an example of how this works, I've got a gentleman that ranches in Oklahoma, and he has a small area or a large area in central Kansas where he runs calves in every summer. Due to the drought we've had in Oklahoma, he sold off the calves early and moved his cows to Kansas. Well, those calves weren't sold in a disaster area, but by the decision to move those cows, that would cause a premature sale. That situation qualified. So they don't have to be raised or sold in the area, but that drought condition had to be caused or had to cause the sale. Now, the sale can take place before or after the declaration is made. As long as the drought condition starts and we see what's coming on, after if the cattle are sold before we actually have a declaration in place, well, as long as it's the same drought or weather-related condition, then those animals will qualify. And history, the taxpayer's history, well, that's used to determine that number of animals that's sold normally and use that to compare it to those that are sold prematurely or earlier due to the drought. Now, the deferral also, sales proceeds, deferred and reported as income in the year following the sale. That would be the normal year that those animals would have been sold. You simply attach a statement to the return showing normal sales, excess sales, and an evidence of the weather-related condition. And normally when you have a FEMA or Secretary of Ag declaration, FSA has declaration numbers that go with those. FEMA also has declaration numbers. And those aren't typically too hard to find. If you go to the FSA website, you can find typically the FSA declarations. Call your state FSA office. They can also provide those for particular counties. So that was the first one, first set of rules. The second set of rules talk about involuntary conversion. Now, what that means is basically we're looking at this and we're taking those animals and we have a decision that we are going to replace them within a period of time. So what the rules state, purchase, replacement, draft, breeding, or dairy livestock within a two-year period, remember, does not apply to poultry, does not apply to calves. Now, the replacement period, that can be extended 2 years to 4 years if the area has been declared eligible for federal disaster assistance by either any of the federal government or any of its agencies. Also, the drought can persist for more than 3 years. That replacement period can even go longer. To give you an example, we've got some counties in Oklahoma. We've just reached our seventh year of extreme, exceptional, severe drought. So our replacement period, we're now into our eighth year of being able to postponing those animal replacements or purchase 8 years. So like I said, that replacement period, it can be extended. You don't have to be looking at a four-year plan if the drought situation or drought conditions persist. Now, the animals, you know, they can be held any length of time and still qualify, as long as that weather-related condition causes a sale. For example, What happened in Oklahoma, we had guys buying replacement cows. In January, the drought hit. They sold those replacements. So even though they held them probably less than 6 months, definitely less than a year, we could still elect to postpone that recognition until we replaced them within our four-year planning horizon. So it doesn't matter how long we've held them, 1 year or less or longer, we can still postpone recognition. The gain realized, that can be postponed if the sales proceeds are used to repurchase or purchase replacement livestock within that time period that's described. So that if we've got situation didn't go very long, we've got 2 years, extended drought severity, we have 4 years. If we've got disaster declarations that were in place, that extends it to 4 years as well. The only real estate that the replacement animals must be used for the same purpose as those that were sold. Dairy for dairy, breeding for breeding. And you're allowed to make separate elections if you've got cattle versus hogs. You can treat the hogs one way, you can take the cattle the other. So separate elections based upon class of livestock, but all in that class have to be treated the same. Again, no requirement that the weather-related conditions cause the area to be declared a disaster area by the federal government, but for those rules to apply, but it does allow us to have a longer replacement period. All you have to do, if we haven't received federal assistance or federal declarations, all you have to be able to show is the weather-related conditions cause the sale of more animals than normal. Basically, what that applies to is you've got to have the drought monitor map showing that we had severe, exceptional, extreme drought. In that scenario, then we have the two-year buyback rules. To make the election, well, you're going to attach a statement to the tax return. Your tax preparer will do this. All he's going to ask you for is evidence of the weather-related condition, evidence that the drought was there, any disaster declarations to allow longer repurchase replacement period. They're going to compute the amount of gain. That would be what you sold them for. And if it's capital gain, ordinary income, but basically the amount of gain realized, the number and kind of livestock sold, and how many of those would have been sold under usual or typical business practices, because only those sold in excess of normal are allowed to be deferred. A question that often comes up, and this is very confusing, because people look at it, well, if I sold 100 cows, does that mean I have to buy 100 cows back? No, it doesn't. Under the rules for this particular election, if you sold $1,000 worth of per cow and you sold 10 of them, so $10,000, you do not have to buy 10 cows. You have to buy $10,000 worth of cows. So it doesn't matter how many head it was. You're just dealing in the dollars. So you have to take track of the dollar spent, and the tax basis in those new cows will be essentially the tax basis of what was sold. Because what you've done is deferred the income tax reporting, so the new animals will retain the basis of the old animals sold. Now, if the drought condition continues, and I don't have this slide in here, but if the drought condition that we've experienced in Oklahoma and some of these areas has gone 7 years, a lot of these folks, it's going to take more than a few years to even get the grass back. Consequently, they're not going to be able to buy cows. There's a rule in the tax code that allows, in that scenario, in that situation where you can't replace with livestock, you can replace or buy back with business property used in the farming operation. So we can buy back equipment, tractors, some machinery equipment, even real property, real estate, in that scenario, so that if we can't buy back cows, we can have a parcel of land we're looking at. Well, the basis in those cows, you're going to adjust the basis in that land accordingly. So all we're doing is postponing the income recognition, income tax bite. We're going to postpone that in the land, and it's going to carry forward. So it doesn't disappear, it just gets postponed. So which options to select? Here comes the fun part, not an easy answer.
Economic situations are different. Tax situations are different. Goals are different. Some things to think about, and under the current tax scenario of tax laws, it makes it even more complicated. Here's what we're looking at. If you look at 2012 and our current tax rates, we're saying, well, I've got this income. Should I postpone it or should I report it this year and have a clean slate for the future? Well, for 2012, any sales due to drought, our tax rates are 10 to 35%. Lower tax rates than what we will see for 2013. Ordinary income tax rates beginning in 2013, unless something happens, are going to be from 15 to 39.6%. That may make it very much more beneficial to report the income this year and tax it at lower taxable rates. Same thing with capital gains. Under current scenarios, 0-15, 2013 projected 10 and 20%. So some things to think about. Now, that 10 and 20% under certain scenarios, if you held the animals more than 5 years, that's 8 and 18, but still it doesn't necessarily behoove the situation of holding on, not reporting that income this year. It may be better to go ahead and pay the tax at the lower rates. Again, you're going to have to talk to your tax preparer and see what it is that is most beneficial to you. Well, I did put that slide in concerning the economic circumstances. If they change related business property, just move it to a different portion. To help, again, make that selection, there's some information on realtax.org. There's tax topics there. The weather-related sales information is a great source of information concerning what it is you need to keep, the rules. It basically contains everything in this presentation that I've talked about in a very, hopefully very simple form to understand. Take that information to your tax preparer, then have them look at the different consequences of the two alternatives, and just because what your neighbor selected may not be the best item or selection for you as well. Like I said, everybody's tax situation is different. Everybody's economic situation and goals are different as well. Well, that pretty much covers the discussion. Jeff, I believe you're responsible for posing questions. I'll be around to answer those.
Yes. Thanks, Stacy. This weather-related sales of livestock is really important to many of our producers. A couple of the questions. In today's world, JC, many farmers and ranchers form corporations, partnerships, LLPs, LLCs. Some of those LLCs filing as corporations, others as partnerships, and the list goes on. How do these, or do these entities still qualify to make the 1033E and 451E elections? Are they limited? What's the story there?
They're not limited on the 1033E because basically that applies to any livestock, any situation. You don't have the same requirements. The one-year deferral under 451E requires that they are use cash method of accounting. So depending upon the corporation, if you're required to use accrual accounting, which I would be surprised if there are any, that's a pretty sizable operation. A lot of those are still allowed to use cash method accounting. That shouldn't have much impact either. So LLCs, no matter how they're taxed, you've really got to look at what the tax structure is for that entity. And if they use the cash method of accounting, they're fine. If they use accrual method or have elected accrual method, the 451E election is not available.
Okay. Another question on the 1033E and 451. You know, as you said, you've had 7 years of drought in some Oklahoma counties. Southeastern Colorado we've had basically since 2001, but the drought has persisted over several years, and it's caused a producer to make that 1033E election in multiple years.
Right.
And what's the steps that producer must follow to, you know, can he continue to show the number of animals was more than normally would sold? How's that history related in there?
Okay, let me make sure I understand what you're asking. So Let's say we had a producer with 1,000 cows in 2001, and he kept reducing
right.
his herd. And
yes, due to drought.
So, again, his normal culling practices would have been established before the drought started, the continuation of the droughts occurred. So
right.
as the drought has continued, we still go back and look at that history prior to drought conditions. The drought conditions are causing them to do things that are not normal, not typical. Consequently, from where I understand the rules and all the pieces of that puzzle is, he's allowed to still continue to look at prior to drought decisions. Once we got into the drought scenario, we're in an issue where anything basically that's occurred here is in excess of normal culling on a typical basis.
So normal is a stat. Yes, so normal selling rates are established prior to the drought, regardless of the length of that drought.
Right. So in the scenario where I was just describing, these guys have been replacing some of those animals, but they haven't been able to replace really anything other than just dead animals that have died, things like this. They really have not even begun to attack the situation where they're trying to rebuild the herd or do a true replacement. And so consequently, they're just buying a few at a time. Yes, that does apply to the drought rules, the replacement rules, but under the 1033E, yes, if we had to turn around and sell those, then we're still under this drought. That continues forward as well.
Okay. Another question that's been posed is, how much documentation and what is sufficient documentation to prove drought caused the sale? Can it be newspaper articles? Does it need to be the drought monitor? What else might?
Drought monitor is probably the easiest one to get a hold of. Also, and I'm not sure I mentioned this, the Internal Revenue Service, every August, nationwide, looks at weather and drought, floods, the whole bit, and looks at the disaster declarations. And the past notice that came out, it's IRS Notice 2012-62, that came out in September of this year. It lists every state and every county in those states where we've had severe, extreme drought, where we would have had any kind of presidential or Secretary of Ag disaster declarations. So that's IRS Notice 2012-62, and you can go back and find those historically. They're on the IRS website, and that is the best way, easiest way, to document every year's drought and disaster declarations. So flood, fire, everything.
Okay. The next question is related to fires. Does wind-driven wildland fire devastation qualify as a weather-related event?
It can. Situation occurred, we had 90,000 acres burn in August of this year in Oklahoma, one area. They basically lost all their animals. We haven't had enough rain to replenish that. They've sold off everything. In that scenario, the fire did get them some disaster declarations. They said no grazing. And until it rains in that area, they're not going to have any grass coming back. That allowed them to then use these rules.
Okay, good.
It burned up all this hay, all their existing feed, everything.
Right. How might a producer handle the sale of business-related horses, be they draft or just ranch-use horses, sold due to drought or disaster conditions?
The same way. Horses, again, if you're looking at replacing them, same scenario. You've got, look at the value of the horse that was sold, horses that were sold, and he's replaced dollar for dollar on those coming back in, and the basis then carries forward. So if you have three horses and you only buy back two, well, the basis of the new two horses will be the basis of the three horses split between the two of them.
Okay. So one final question, JC. Suppose a rancher decides to switch from cow-calf to stocker due to increasing climate variability. Are there any tax policies or strategies that might lessen the tax burden of that person that's selling the cow-calf pairs and purchasing stockers?
Not really. Well, the only thing that can help there is the 451E election, where you can take the sales in excess of normal and move that into the following year. Because when you're switching from cow-calf to a stocker-type enterprise, you're not buying back breeding animals, so for that postponement will not work. So you're just allowed to use that 451E, and to my knowledge, there's nothing else that's really of any benefit in terms of those. Now, I guess if you look at it from the standpoint of excess sales, you could probably use some of the income averaging rules, some things like that. Roger may be talking about those pieces in his section, but there's some other tax planning tools out there that you can use to level income, pre-purchasing expenses, things like that, plus also income averaging, those issues which we didn't really touch on in this presentation.
Right. Well, thanks, JC. We really appreciate your time and knowledge, willingness to share those skills with people across the country. I guess one of the strong take-home points that I have from your presentation is, you know, we're more knowledgeable, but we better talk to our own tax preparer to see how these rules might apply to our own operation.
That is correct.
Well, our second speaker this morning is Danny Kleinfelter. He is a professor and extension economist with Texas AgriLife Extension and Texas A&M University. Additionally, Danny is the director of the Executive Program for Agricultural Producers, co-director of the Texas A&M Family and Owner-Managed Business Program, and serves as executive secretary for the Association of Agricultural Production Executives. I'm not sure where he finds the time, but Dr. Kleinfelter also serves as a member of the board of Ag Texas Farm Credit Services and president of his family's Illinois Farm Corporation. Danny has authored or co-authored 8 books and over 400 articles on management and finance. In addition to his long and very distinguished academic career, Dr. Kleinfelter spent 10 years in commercial banking and the farm credit system. In 2009, the 25th anniversary issue of the Top Producer magazine listed him as one of the 25 people in the world who will have the greatest influence on the future of American agriculture. And the following year, Danny received the American Agricultural Editors Association's Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award. We are honored to have Dr. Danny Kleinfelter speak to us this morning about cash flow planning and analysis during times of drought. Danny, welcome, and the mic is all yours.
All right. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to start with a couple of things. Let me just go ahead and move to the second page. Is the first two sheets of what I have for an extension economist are going to be very redundant. But what I found is when I deal with producers, before I go into any financial statement, I talk about what are the uses of that statement. You're not just doing it as a requirement for somebody. It has value. So let me run over those quickly. The one thing about the cash flow or the cash flow budget is it provides the best measure of operational liquidity as opposed to structural liquidity on the balance sheet. It's the ability to meet financial obligations as they become due without disrupting the ongoing continuing operation of the business. The second, as a projected tool, the statement helps formalize the overall planning process. By that, I mean it gets it down on paper. Third, it can assist in evaluating borrowing needs and repayment plans. When are you going to need the money, how much, and when can you pay it back? Fourth, it serves as a financial control tool. By the monitoring through the year of the actual performance versus what was budgeted and looking at the variances, it allows the farmer to know whether he needs to change the plan, alter it, or take action instead of waiting until too much time has passed. Fifth, it formalizes the process of integrating the budgets and plans for the various enterprises of the business many businesses are composed of many enterprises, not just commodities, but in some cases related businesses. At some point, you have to pull it all together to look at how it works. Sixth, directs attention to the management of cash reserves. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's not a big issue, but it definitely has been in the corn and soybean country. How much do you have at surplus at times? How long are you likely to have it? What are your options to temporarily use that cash to maximize the return to the business? Fifth, if you put together different what-if scenarios or projections for different alternatives, it's a very practical tool from my standpoint of analyzing or the impact of risk or uncertainty on the business. Fifth, it really helps assess the relationship among your production, marketing, and financial plans. Instead of just treating them as separately, any top manager has to look at that as an integrated whole. We in academia sometimes teach our specialty area, but that farmer's got to put it all together. Ninth, by comparing projected cash flows under current operations and then under modified operations, it can serve as an investment analysis tool. Basically, you know, what kind of debts are going to take on, what kind of repayment requirements, additional expenses, additional and timing of revenue, if we take this on as opposed to the current situation, helps you analyze the feasibility of investments. The last one isn't what it can do, it's what it can't do. The cash flow, even though farmers are on cash accounting for tax purposes, is not a good measure of profitability. Accrual adjusted or true accrual accounting is the only thing that can really reflect profitability. Cash accounting can typically lead to 2 or 3 year lags in recognizing profitability problems. The thing that bothers a lot of farmers is they're cash flowing and not sure what their lenders are so concerned about. The reality is a farm can be going broke and cash flowing just the same as it can be profitable and unable to cash flow. There's a lot of reasons for that, and we could go into it if anybody wants to talk about that later. All right, let's turn to the third slide. Well, my arrow will click. Here's what I think the biggest problem is. The biggest problem for most producers is budgeting accuracy. There was one study, and it was within Farm Credit, so it hasn't been published as an academic journal, that looked at over 300 farm borrowers over a four-year period of time. And on average, this 300 overestimated their cash receipts by 15% and underestimated their cash expenditures by 17%. The thing you got to realize, that's not a 32% error. As a percent of the estimated net cash flow, that was over a 300% error. And it's real hard to run a business if you're that far off. The point is, if errors were purely a function of price and quantity variability, then receipts should have been underestimated as often as they were overestimated. Same is true of expenditures, underestimated as often as overestimated. What it shows here, when there's a consistent bias upward on revenue, downward on expenditures, that either the projections were based on too much wishful thinking or optimism, there wasn't enough good information to actually prepare the statement, or there was a deliberate attempt on the part of the preparer to present the best case scenario as, in fact, as if it were the most likely. Now, we all know borrowers, and that'd be true of me as well, are going to be inclined to cast the best light on the situation if I'm providing it to my lender. But one thing they don't need to be doing is basically kidding themselves. Okay, well, I'm getting this a little slow here. The typical producers I've found, at least in my extension meetings, treat financial planning analysis, particularly cash flow, as a beginning and end of the year exercise. They do one, a projected for their lender. The other, at the end of the year, they summarize their cash information for tax purposes. But even then, for the most part, the typical producer sees this as more of a chore than it is an opportunity. The most successful managers, on the other hand, spend a lot of time on planning, monitoring, and analyzing performance. And by staying on top of how things are going, they're much more likely to be prepared for those things that could and do happen, to spot problems early enough on and opportunities early enough on, that they can fix them or take advantage of them before it's too late. Now we're looking at drought, not just drought, but any time of stress. My point is that it becomes even more important that producers put a lot of emphasis on cash flow planning and analysis in those periods. I'm going to look at three best practices that I see a lot of the top 1% of producers in this country employing. Now, I know there's the 99 versus a 1%, but the top 1% of producers in this country produce nearly 40% of our output. So it's the larger, not just huge, but larger commercial operations I'm talking about. The first one, they look at what-if scenarios, sensitivity analysis, and contingency planning. Essentially, what we're doing here is they consider what could happen, whether it's good or bad, and I'd underline that and what they would do if it did. They don't limit themselves to these most likely best case and worst case scenarios, which is about as far as we typically go in advising farmers and looking at more just than what you expect to happen. But they use their judgment, the historical records and experience they have, as well as the current outlook that Extension or USDA are providing in order to make those estimates. The other thing is they don't limit themselves to the last few years. One of the things I hear all the time, I've heard it in the grain business lately and others, is this concept, it's a new paradigm. These guys take that with a real heavy dose of salt. They tend to be less caught up by that in the irrational exuberance that everybody jump on board going up and the irrational fear, the rats fleeing a sinking ship on the downside. They're looking over time. Third thing is they take both a long-term view of planning when considering scenarios. I know right now, and most producers are just worried about next year. These guys are taking a short-term, but as well as long-term. I'm going to cover just a few of these. For example, in the long-term, they look at the four Ds that family businesses talk about. Death, divorce, disability, departure. Basically, what would we do if that happened? You know, what's our succession plan? Do we have a buy-sell agreement in place between the ownership parties in order to deal with it? We've obviously got a lot of things like drought, disease output we have to look at. But more immediate things, the idea of what if output prices, what if land prices or yields fell by 50% next year? They did that a lot of places this year. Equally, what if input prices were to double? Those sort of things are what I'm looking at in terms of evaluating these what-if scenarios. One of the things I've found is if you're looking at, and I'll take corn, soybeans, you can tell I originally come from Illinois, but we tend to look at things in 10 bushel yield increments, like 100, 110, 130, and look at prices on a 50 cent price moves. I mean, if we've got a 200-bushel base and we've got a 50% price move, we're talking about $100 an acre. I mean, that's more, it's not so granulated that this is just ultimately time-consuming, but it's a lot more time-consuming than a lot of producers put into it. The second thing is they evaluate and consider all possible risk mitigation options, not just what they typically done. If they see something new come on board, they evaluate it. That, you know, whether this is insurance, revenue or margin insurance, just straight crop insurance, looking at options, puts and calls, pre-purchasing, contract, developing contracts if you're a contract supplier or buyer, with modifications within it, or the idea of trying to move to flex leases from cash rents. Those are all, as well as other things we see, things that they try to pursue or look at. Okay, third, the second is we're looking at regular monitoring and analysis between projected and actual cash flows, down to individual line items. This may be monthly or quarterly evaluations, depending on the nature of the business. But if unusual circumstances arise, it's going to happen more often. What they're trying to do is the following. The first is to identify base or biases. Is there an area we consistently are overly optimistic or overly pessimistic? You see that a lot. What you realize is your opinion is biased in some way. You need to figure out why and adjust for that. And also your major areas of risk or otherwise major areas of variability. Which line items or areas within the business are having the greatest volatility over time? That's where you need to focus your risk management efforts. What it does is allow them to be better able to capitalize on opportunities and correct problems, as well as adjusting future plans if things are changing. You know, it's like heart problems or cancer, anything of that nature. If you're getting blood pressure increasing, a cholesterol buildup, then you need to do something about it. A cancer, if it's trapped or captured in its before it metastasizes, is very treatable. Same with heart. If the damage has already been done before the heart, the cancer metastasizes, the heart attack occurs, even if the person or the business survives, it can't be as strong as it was before. Okay. One of the things these guys realize, and most of you have probably seen this yourself, is the biggest difference they found between the top 10% of producers and the rest of the top 25%, I don't mean the top 25 versus the bottom, is largely timing. When they buy, when they sell, when they enter a new area, when they expand, when they cut back, when they reallocate. A lot of the staying on top of it is to improve their timing. It's obvious and it's pretty easy to see when you look at commodity market moves, weather changes, other stock markets even. But this applies to all areas of the business. The other thing about a really top producer or a very business-oriented one is every item in that spreadsheet or whatever they're using to develop their budget projections is every item is tied to a set of assumptions. What that does is if there are differences in that number than what they projected, it makes it easier for them to drill down to causes and not be focusing so much on symptoms. That's a problem our government has. That's a problem voters, general population, and the media have. They're real symptom-oriented. That isn't the way to fix things. F on here is monitoring isn't just limited to what happened, what has happened. I mean, if you're looking at projected versus actual cash flows, one of the things you have to look at the time is not just whether there's a variance now, but at the time you're doing that assessment, look at, have the external environment, expectations change to let you know, should we in fact adjust our budget going forward? It's like a coach making halftime adjustments if he's playing football. Okay, turn to the last one of these are autopsies. This is one I think is extremely important. This is one that use the least of all of these. It's basically conducting debriefings on the results of key decisions, whether things went well or badly, after the fact. Like the Blue Angel performance pilot team, every performance they sit down and have a debriefing. When you've got two planes coming at each other, $30 million aircraft at several hundred miles an hour, they can't afford mistakes. And so these sessions get honest and brutal. I mean, otherwise you're going to have $60 million in molten steel, you're going to have two dead pilots, and the possibility of harming and even killing a great deal of spectators. We used to do the same thing with loan officers and sitting down on loans that had problems and went bad or caused a loss. What happened here? What did we learn from it so that you don't do the same thing over? All right. When we're looking at this, why things turned out the way they did, and that's the purpose of this. I'll just hit several points. What you're trying to do is decide, what did we overlook? What assumptions at the beginning of the year did we make that were wrong? what could we have done after the fact differently? Hindsight's always 20/20. Were there mid-course adjustments we should have made and even could have? Are there any risk mitigation tools, or could we have done contingency planning to help us deal with this situation? Are there either any leading indicators or better information that would help us in the future? You know, if we'd have known about the weather conditions developing in Brazil or an economic problem in China, whether what's happening in Europe, other sorts of things, Iran, those can play a big deal in what's going to happen, oil, other price movements. Okay. The other point here, just think about this, because this happens, you listen to this in the coffee shop talk. If they bought low or sold high, the question is, were they just lucky, or did they have a marketing plan or decision plan and process that they can repeat or use again? More in the opposite. They sold low, bought high. The issue is, looking back on it, were there opportunities that they missed? More important, and the reason for doing all this, is what do we learn? And what are we going to do differently in the future? Are we going to repeat things because we found we have something that works? Or does this mean we really need to change? The old saying by Einstein, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Another thing about these autopsies that I think helps a lot in family farms, family businesses, they're a great team communication and learning tool. You have the management team and the key members of the group sitting down together talking about this. Everybody learns something. The other, it's really important for successor development. The son, the daughter, whatever that's coming up. Being involved in these situations going along really brings them in and helps them grow as a decision maker based on somebody else's experience as well as their own. It's really important to keep notes and written minutes to develop action plans and assign responsibilities and timetables on these things. Because as you all know, procrastination is very real and memories are very short and selective. You ask them what their assumptions were before the year and what I got, unless they wrote it down in their cash flow plan. It's a great deal of difference. If you've ever been in court, you'll find witnesses have incredible differences as to what they saw. I'm going to close with this one. It's a couple of quotes. I think we all need to remember everybody, including us, exists in four states of knowledge. Well, you know what you do know. Well, you know what you don't know. That's not so bad. If you know what you don't know, you can work on figuring it out. The dangerous ones are the last two. What you don't know, you don't know. There are a lot of things out there. You're just unaware that you're unaware. This is ignorance, not stupidity. The last one is where you think you know something, and it just isn't true. Those are the two areas. This is why I'm real big on pushing these peer advisory groups and these debriefing meetings. I think we can learn from each other. The last one I'm going to point out is Douglas Adams was a quote in a book called The Breakthrough Company. It's kind of the small business version of Good to Great. Human beings, he said, who are almost unique in their ability to learn from the experiences of others, are also remarkable for their disinclination to do so. Okay, that's how I'm going to wrap up. In terms of this entire webinar, I'm the only one not talking about taxes, but I think this part of it, both now and more importantly under stress, but going forward, is going to be extremely important.
Well, thank you, Danny. You did a great job of explaining the value in cash flow planning and analysis, especially during extreme weather conditions, and I agree with the need for and the ever-growing importance of cash flows. A couple of questions for you, or a few questions. You know, drought is a kind of a creeping disaster as opposed to a single event. At what point should a producer begin conversation with his or her lender, partners, others, when conditions are causing major changes to be made?
Sooner the better. The lenders see this happening too. And I think both at the time you apply, even if drought hasn't come about, you know, last year with cornbread, where we thought we were going to have record yields and other things, I think the fact the person demonstrates they've thought about it and what they, if there's any risk mitigation tools and what they would do if it does happen, tells the lender an awful lot about their management ability and the way they think. Then as you go along, the first time you recognize it's starting to happen, even if you don't think it's severe as it's going to be, or it might correct itself, which it could. But they still think it's useful to go in and see your lender and sit down and talk to him.
Okay. Good. In your studies and experiences, have you noticed any differences such as age, gender, enterprise mix, mindset, anything else between the most successful producers and the less successful producers in terms of cash flow budgeting and analysis?
I wouldn't say it's chronological age. I think it's middle age. I've seen some, you know, 60-some-year-old guys that are just incredibly progressive. Look at in our academic site, Peter Drucker, as a management mind, was 95 and was thinking ahead of people 30-some. I mean, there's 70-year-olds trapped in 30-year-old bodies, and there's vice versa. But I don't think it's an age thing. I think it's an attitude thing.
Okay, good. One final question, and it's actually a two-part question. From a lender's perspective, and maybe it's from a producer's perspective as well, are there some better ways to encourage rather than simply requiring a farmer or rancher to develop and monitor a cash flow for management purposes? And then,
obviously, oh, go ahead. Sorry, two parts.
The second part of that is, what are your thoughts about a producer or business owner manager developing a statement of cash flows for the lender and for one for himself?
Two separate ones. Kind of the good, looking as good as it can for the lender, and then being willing to tell yourself the truth. If that's what it takes, if you particular, a really good lender, and if you're a good manager, should be willing to look at the fact that you've considered those different options. You have some lenders that the best thing you can do is kind of present a, not lie, but a situation that's pretty positive. If you've ever told them something, you know, we've looked at this option, and they put it in file, and a bank examiner comes along and uses that against them, then you've got some issues. But
right,
in terms of incentivizing people, there are some lenders. Back when Tom Fry and I put together coordinated financial statements, and that's where some of you guys were born, we had lenders doing training sessions and then offering borrowers who brought in complete statement, cash or accrual, monitored cash flows and other things, that would give them, incentivize them to provide to produce lower interest rates, either up front or in effect at the end of the year, have a rebate, an interest rebate. You know, if you met all of these requirements, we'll recalculate your interest or give you a discount starting toward next year. And this, that could always be, it's easier there, less next year, this our going rate. Now, people are always going to say, yeah, well, you say that, but this is, but most, you know, a lender could, he couldn't say who, but he could say, I'm charging farmers rates that range right now, let's say on operating money, from 9 to 5%. And most of that is my cost of doing business with them and the risk in the loan.
Sure.
And if you can make a difference on this, I'm going to share that with you because you cut my risk and you cut the lender or my regulatory pressure.
Good. Good, good. Well, Danny, we really appreciate your comments and your willingness to ask questions. We look forward to hearing more from you in the future, and I think some of us will actually be going to some of your website information looking for some of these multiple fact sheets that you've written. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Now, I want to thank all of our speakers today, J.C. Hobbs at Oklahoma State University, Danny Kleinfelter at Texas A&M University, and Roger McGowan at Iowa State for their insightful comments today. They were excellent and really caused some people to think. I think their presentations will be of great benefit to farmers, ranchers, lenders, and others as they make some difficult decisions over the next few months. I want to remind everyone that these presentations will be recorded or have been recorded. Those will be at our website, farmmanagement.org, and you can go on there and see the recordings, more information about the speakers, etc. We're going to be bringing some polling questions across here. We'd really like for you to answer these. This is helpful information. This one is prior to the seminar. How aware were you of the issues discussed today? This is going to change. While these are coming across, we did get another question while Roger was speaking from the audience, and that is there anything in the tax code to defer taxes on potato, grain operations, and that is similar to cattle operations due to severe drought? We would normally have JC answer this since he spoke on taxes, but given that I have some experience with tax law, I'll take a stab at this. I'm unaware of anything in the tax code that allows for that. And the main reason for this is that grains, potatoes, crops have there's a storage or storability of those. So you can move those the sale of those crops from one year to the next, whereas cattle have a definite lifespan. But I really encourage anyone to go to ruraltax.org, where we have a number of fact sheets on taxes, as well as talk to your individual tax advisor on this type of thing. This polling question, what is your greatest take-home point from today's seminar? And this one is your likelihood of participating in a future webinar. I know we've had many, many webinars over the years, and it's very helpful to when we solicit funding or come up with ideas for the webinars that we have your input. Again, the speakers, J.C. Hobbs, Danny Kleinfelter, Roger McGowan, did an excellent job. You know, this webinar was brought to you in part by the American Ag Econ Association Extension Committee. If you would like more information or would like to consider joining them, please visit the website at www.aaea.org. If you have any ideas or topics or comments about today's seminar that you would like to see covered in future webinars, please use the Q&A chat pod on your left-hand side of the screen. Put that in there, or you can contact us through the farmmanagement.org website. There is that URL, if you will, or the two things. You can also reach those of us in our various states that we can provide some assistance on that. There's a file share pod that has just come onto your screen. It is provides some web links. You can highlight that and then click Save to My Computer, and it will download much information for you. With that, I want to thank our speakers, the support team behind the scenes that did an excellent job today, Montana State University for the technology support. And we really want to thank all of the participants for sharing just a part of your busy day with us. We hope you found some of the information useful and applicable to your situations, your business, if you are a lender to your customers. If you have further questions, please contact us. And with that, we will say good day and thank you.